Hi! If you're a fan of Nonprofit Lowdown, you might be interested in my weekly free newsletter where I send out weekly inspiration for fundraising, notices about any upcoming events that I'm doing, and a cute dog picture. So check it out at rhegawong.com, rhegawong.com. Welcome to Nonprofit Lowdown. I'm your host, Rhea Wong. Hey, podcast listeners, it's Rhea Wong with you once again with Nonprofit Lowdown. Today, my guest is Dr. Patton McDell, and we are going to talk about the 7 steps to nonprofit leadership. Patton is a founder of PMA Nonprofit Leadership, and like me, is a podcaster and an author. His book and podcast are both called Your Path to Nonprofit Leadership. So he's kind of the expert on the paths of nonprofit leadership. Patton.
Rhea, delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
I am delighted to have you as well. And actually, what's really fun is we're starting to expand. We used to be a very heavily New York-based guest list, and you are in beautiful North Carolina.
Indeed. Charlotte, to be exact. So delighted to represent the Southeast for this conversation.
Excellent. And for the basketball fans out there, Patton actually went to UNC, so we had a little Michael Jordan moment. Another. I think that's a different podcast. It's like the Rainbow right. Podcast.
We can always add that to the list if we need to. But yes, it was fun to be there close to when he was in fact on campus.
Oh, so exciting. Okay, before we jump into the details of what we're going to talk about, can you walk us through a little bit about your path in the nonprofit world?
Yeah, happy to. And Rhea, thanks again for the opportunity. I was by chance offered an internship while at UNC Chapel Hill with Special Olympics International. And so what I thought might be a fun summer in Washington, D.C. became a career-defining opportunity. And so I was there when Eunice Kennedy Shriver, the founder of that global movement, was still actively managing and leading SOI, as we called it. And it just opened my eyes to opportunities of nonprofit leadership, and frankly, the complexity and depth of nonprofit organizations. And so from there, I ended up working there and at the North Carolina office for about 8 years, wanted to continue to sharpen my fundraising skills, and so got into higher education. I was a vice chancellor down at UNC Wilmington, another UNC institution. So I had a fantastic experience leading fundraising, alumni relations, all of what is called university advancement for my higher ed friends in the room and listening. And then went to Queen's University here in Charlotte, also had an opportunity to lead a development or a fundraising team. So 10 years in higher ed then led to what I do now. About 15 years ago, I decided I felt like I had experience that could benefit others and had learned so much from leaders like Mrs. Shriver. So I started PMA Nonprofit Leadership. And that is the consulting practice I have now. I've got some wonderful colleagues that work with me, and we've been able to work with almost 250 organizations now, strategic planning, fundraising, and you won't be surprised to hear, nonprofit leadership, of course, is my favorite. And so that's what we do.
So Patton, thank you for that. When you and I talked, when I was on your podcast, you spoke a little bit about, I think you had a mastermind that you were running with nonprofit leaders. And why don't I just delve into definitions a little bit, because I think leadership is a word that's thrown around a lot, means different things to different people, has become very sort of buzzy to say, but I don't know that we have a precise definition. So how would you define leadership?
Love that question, Rhea. And you're right. I think a lot of people use leadership and management interchangeably. And in fact, as a nonprofit leader, you certainly have to have management skills. And in fact, in the book, I talk about there are, in my opinion, 10 essential skills and experiences you need, many of which are management oriented. But my definition of leadership is what I've kind of come to at this point, is the ability to first of all, to attract and retain talented people. You need followers. To define your leadership, you have to have folks following. And in fact, I think there are 5 distinct areas that represent the best leaders. They can attract and retain talented staff. They can attract and retain board members. They can attract and retain community partners. And they can also, of course, attract and retain funders. And so much of the relationship building that I think is essential to leadership is how I've come to define it. And again, not to dismiss all of those management elements, but can you attract and retain? I think I left out one of the five, volunteers. But as I think about the best nonprofit leaders I've worked with, they're good at all five. And that, Rhea, to me, defines what are really good leaders.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you put it in that context. I've not thought of it that way, but that's exactly right. As a leader of a nonprofit, you're constantly interfacing with different constituents, and your job is to really attract, retain, and I would say grow and deepen the relationship
Absolutely
with these
right.
folks. So, all right, let's just jump right into it, because that is the name of the webinar. People want to know, what are the 7 steps to nonprofit leadership, Ben?
Hoping you would ask that, and in fact, the book is an opportunity for me to unpack these 7 concepts. The kind of analogy we're using here is a path, but it really should be better defined as a circular path. These are 7 concepts I believe nonprofit leaders and aspiring leaders need to constantly focus. So it's not like you kind of make a stop and you check it off your list.
Why don't you give us a big overview, and then we can deep dive on each one, if that's okay.
Happy to. Number one, sharpen your vision. I devote a whole chapter to this. The best nonprofit leaders have clarity about their long-term vision. And I use an exercise called a vision framework, which again helps you define not just you want to be an executive director, let's say, but in what sector, in what geography, what size and scope do you want to work with? So that's number one, sharpen your vision. Number two, I call map your course. And that's both a self-assessment process as well as putting some clarity and kind of time horizons on your plan, 1, 3, even 10 years. Number three, I call get in shape. And while we all need to think about the literal interpretation of fitness, sleeping, eating, exercising, but I'm using this term also to include getting in shape to be a leader, because I'm convinced the volume will come at you fast and hard. And so you need to be ready, including those rituals and routines that help you manage the volume and the many aspects of being a leader. Number four, I call curate knowledge, meaning that the data coming at us is just literally overwhelming. And the best leaders, I believe, have a clearly thought out plan to what information do they need, how do they organize it, and then how do they build in systems to learn it. It's one thing to have all this stuff in our inbox, right, or the pile on our desk, but how do we curate it and determine what is essential for us to learn to be more successful? So that's a whole concept there. Number five, I call it express yourself. The best leaders, I think all of you would agree, often are skilled communicators. And it doesn't mean they all have to be on stage, but I do think there are essential communication skills and tools you have to employ: written, speaking, presentation, and just interpersonal. You are going to be in all of these settings as a nonprofit leader. And fortunately, all of these things can be developed and improved. And so that's what this kind of express yourself concept is focused on. Number six, build community. And all of you, you wouldn't be here if you weren't interested in strategic networking. So I get into that a lot. I've been fortunate, frankly, at every step of my career journey because of networking contacts that opened my eyes or opportunities. And so I get into the book about having strategic interviews. In other words, tactical activities that you can expand your network and perhaps create a mutually beneficial bond. And I'm suggesting we all should have a personal board of directors. And I expand on that in the book as well. And last but not least, Rhea, I just call practice leadership. The best leaders I've found in our mastermind program in particular uses this mantra of you need to coach and be coached. And I think that's a lifetime commitment. There's always someone behind you on the path that you can help. And frankly, teaching is a wonderful way to sharpen your skills. And there are people ahead of you on the path. And you need to be willing and self-aware to take feedback and be willing to get better. So I hope that makes sense, Rhea. That's a rapid fire, all 7.
Yeah. So let me just reiterate all 7 for folks. And I want to do a bit of a deep dive. So the first is sharpen your vision. The second is
map your course.
Okay. The third is get in shape. I love that. Fourth, curate knowledge. Fifth, express yourself. 6, build community, and 7, practice leadership, coach, and be coached. Is that right?
Absolutely right. Correct.
Okay. So let's do a deep dive here, Patton. Of all of these 7, which is your personal favorite?
The first one, sharpen your vision. Well, what I find many nonprofit leaders, talented, aspiring leaders, have a general sense of where they want to go. Usually it's a senior leadership position, but they just have a hard time breaking it down into action steps. And so I have found the vision framework that I mentioned has been as valuable as anything that I did. And again, I've applied all of these personally and now try to utilize them in my coaching and mastermind programs, because I think it allows folks to create a path literally going forward. And I mentioned kind of, once we know, if are you willing to move into a different sector, or do you want to stay in education? Is it healthcare? Is it arts and culture? There's no wrong answer. But by thinking intentionally about what I am willing to do and might be effective, often it's not the sector they're in now. They would entertain something else. Same with geography. Now, maybe you are tied to your community and that's fine, but would you move for the right opportunity? These are the kind of questions that I think lead to powerful introspection. And that's why I guess, Rhea, I really like that first step, because everything that follows can be defined more clearly when you have that clarity up front.
Yeah, it reminds me of Patrick Lencioni and how he talks about the job of a leader is to provide clarity, to create clarity, clarity. Indeed. Up and down. Even if people don't like it, at least you're clear about what's happening.
Absolutely true.
So as we think about this, I want to talk about get in shape, because I think that is an area where a lot of leaders might be lacking. So whether that means self-care, right? Because I know
yeah,
we
exactly.
have a high burnout rate in the sector. I mean, I think there's a real sort of ethos in our sector. I hope it's changing, but it's almost like our martyrdom. Like if I can sacrifice myself, if I'm working 90 hours a week and I don't sleep and I don't eat and I don't see my kids and I don't, then I'm somehow... I call it EDing harder. Like I am
exactly right.
I'm the best ED because look at what I'm sacrificing. So talk a little bit about get in shape. Is that physical or metaphorical or emotional? Like what does that mean?
Both and all. And I'm glad you raised it, because you're right. I do think martyrdom is an issue in our sector. And I admire and applaud the intensity that many of our nonprofit colleagues bring. But if you're emailing me at 3 a.m, I worry that you're burning the candle at every end, and it's not going to sustain. And it's something you and I've talked about before. We worry about the sector and turnover and all that. And so if we're not taking care of ourselves, we're certainly not going to sustain an organization. But in literal terms, I talk about, yeah, you need to. I'm not in a position to give you advice on diet, sleep, or exercise, but I know you need to be thinking about it. And I encourage all the folks I'm coaching is, we call it the big three. What can you do in one of those three? Maybe it's change your sleep routine, get more sleep. Maybe it is eat better. Maybe it is exercise. Maybe it is practice meditation, something to take care of yourself. But I'm hoping simply to get them talking about it, thinking about it, so that perhaps they will be thoughtful. But something else we do, Rhea, in the mastermind is I find that clutter consumes many of our lives in ways that reduces our efficiency. So we have an exercise where we're like, declutter something. You got too many emails in your inbox. You have too many apps on your phone. You got too much in the pile behind you. I'm literally an example, too much stuff on your desk. As a leader, you're going to have to declutter, I think, to be effective. So that's another example where we talk about getting in shape might mean changing your routines and rituals so that you can handle the volume even better.
I love that, because it reminds me of James Clear's Atomic Habits. Like the habits
yes.
lead
yes.
to the outcomes, right? Because I talk about this a lot with organizational culture change, right? How many times have I decide like, okay, we're going to change the culture, guys. And it just like goes to the mean, because it's all of the habits and processes underneath that support the culture.
Exactly right.
And the other thing that strikes me too is like, I'm reflecting on my own nonprofit leadership. And I think for me, the biggest shift was really just maturity. I mean, I was a 26-year-old ED, and I think I was very insecure, but I because I was insecure, I sort of like outwardly presented being like very confident as a way to cover up. But it wasn't really until I became more mature, more secure in myself that I was able to open myself up to learning opportunities to coach and be coach, right? Because I didn't understand that actually the unwillingness to be coached or to seem vulnerable was actually a weakness and was actually tied to my own insecurity.
That's nice of you to reveal. And I think we've all had some of that. There's a bit of early stage leaders, the imposter syndrome that we sometimes feel. I certainly did as a young vice chancellor at a university, but it's something we can work on. And I think create a community. And that's, again, what I love what you're doing, bringing communities like this together is where I think a lot of support can come. And something else, Rhea, that motivated me on the book was there were three distinct audiences. And one of them that I describe is emerging leaders. I learned from when I started as a consultant, there were a fair number of university programs, both undergraduate and graduate, focused on nonprofit management, leadership, philanthropic studies, or something like that. There are over 300 now. So over 300 in the United States, more and more young, talented professionals are going into our sector. And how do we help them? How do we help the next young, talented Wong who wants to get into nonprofit leadership, wants to be good at it? And that to me is a constant motivation. And I love working with that kind of sector, if you will. But there's another one too, and we all have seen this, our colleagues in the for-profit sector, I call the lateral entry kind of group or cohort. I'm tired of my work in the for-profit sector. Here in Charlotte, there's kind of a banking financial services hub. And I have coffee, I bet, weekly with someone saying, "But I'm tired of it. It just doesn't fulfill me. I think my skills are transferable. So, Patton, what do you think?" And so that leads to a conversation about, all right, let's talk about what is transferable. What do you need to work? And the third, just to put all three of these on the table real quick, is what I call career plateaus. And I bet you've had, Rhea, a lot of these conversations too. Again, that comes in three categories. I'm new, I love it, but I don't know where to go from here. I'm kind of an entry-level position. Help me define a path. The second area is I'm mid-career. I've hit a ceiling. I'm a director level. I want to be executive director. Not sure how to break through that ceiling. And then third is the senior executive director. Now what? I have that conversation. Is Patton, do I move to a bigger nonprofit and try to expand my leadership? Or do I need to think about an exit strategy and maybe do consulting or something else? So I wonder, Rhea, are you running into those? But for me, those three audiences were exactly who I was trying to target with the book.
Yeah, that's so astute. So generally, the folks I talk to tend to be in the last category of executive directors. Yep. Who wonder, like, where do I go from here? And frankly, I mean, let's just be very frank and candid. A lot of executive directors I know are not looking to be an ED again because I think the job is so hard. It demands so much of you. And so often they feel burned out. They feel like they don't have another go in them, at least not right away. So I'm just wondering too, how do you think about the burnout factor? Because I think, especially post-pandemic, I'm just seeing all these EDs leaving the field.
I couldn't agree more. And it gets back to that get in shape, where as much as I admire your dedication to your nonprofit, if I don't sense you have a healthy balance, then I'm concerned and you're going to leave or they're going to push you out because you're not being effective. And so I'm encouraged by what may be a silver lining of the pandemic is a more flexible work schedule. And it has to be modeled though from the top, right? If our leaders don't model this, if they don't take time off, if they don't entertain even a sabbatical, it leads to something, Rhea, you and I have talked about, why the turnover, why the attrition. But I'm convinced most nonprofits aren't sensitive enough to that kind of professional development, which leads to personal development. And that's why we run into some of the problems we have now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such an astute observation because I distinctly remember this, which is, I would say the thing, but I would not model the thing. So I was like, no. You all should definitely take your vacation and definitely do not send emails at 11 o'clock at night. I will, but I don't expect you to do that. And I remember this one time I was out on a Friday night and it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was sending work emails, and I was like, what am I doing right now?
You caught yourself, right? Almost at the
I sent a couple of emails, so I was like, this is crazy. I need to stop doing this, right? But I think part of effective leadership is self-awareness and realizing that what you do is often interpreted more than what you say, right?
Great point.
People are looking at what you do. Okay, I got some questions coming in fast and furious. So let me ask one more question and then we'll get to some Q&A. But we talked about attrition, right? So I think the Great Resignation is real. It certainly hit a lot of different sectors, including ours. I'm part of a network of executive directors, and every week I literally see job descriptions and this person left and we need to fill this position. So, I mean, I don't know what the question is here other than like, what do we do about this? I mean,
why?
But also, what do we do?
I'm glad you gave me a head start on this one because I was excited to talk about it. And I'd be curious about our friends here in the Zoom room, what they think. I think there are four issues. So I broke it down into four issues and we'll be curious, Rhea, your reaction. But in terms of turnover and attrition, I think there are four things. Number one, the kind of expected HR issues, lack of adequate compensation, benefit, lack of a flexible work environment. I think more and more the talented candidates in our sector are going to expect greater flexibility. They've gotten used to it to some extent. And so organizations that can't provide reasonable HR benefits are going to create departures. Number two is unrealistic and overwhelming job descriptions. And I often say this, that the passion for the mission may carry you for a year, year and a half, you know, which I guess is the standard turnover for fundraisers still, 16 months or something like that. But passion will carry you. But eventually, if you're asked to do too much, it is unsustainable. And everybody in this room knows it. They hire you as a development director, but then they want you to manage the events and the website and the database and nine other things. Not going to work. Number three, the growth of the sector, new opportunities. There will be greener pastures all around you. And so, again, this is a kind of note to leaders in the room. What are you doing to retain your talent? Because they are surely going to see opportunities to jump. And sadly, many of them do. Whether it's premature, maybe it doesn't matter. If they decide, they're gone. And then fourth, and this is, of course, what we're talking about, Rhea, and I know you're so committed to with the work you do, but lack of professional development. Because I think many of the conversations I have, they didn't leave because of an HR issue specifically, but the organization just didn't seem to take any interest in my professional development. And a counter to that is those organizations that retain talent, I'm convinced, have a commitment to professional and career development, and it pays off.
There's so much there, but I agree with you 100%, Patton, which is for my program, I talk to a lot of folks about joining and increasing their fundraising skills. And oftentimes the answer I get was, well, I only have $1,000 for professional development, as if like this is just a nice thing that my organization is going to do, as opposed to investing in your assets, your human assets, to build the capacity of the organization. And I think, too, the thing that drives me nuts, I'm just going to put it all out there, is I think as a sector, we have a really short-term view of the world. Like, we don't see that actually by investing and retaining our talent, it's actually saving us money in the long run, because we don't calculate the cost of having to replace somebody. Right. It's usually that person's salary plus, right? So it's like, well, if you had just actually invested $10,000 in that person's growth and kept them in the organization for X number more years, like that actually ends up being a savings of Y number of dollars. But like, we don't...
A multiple, right?
Yeah.
For sure.
I don't know. I guess it's because of like the urgency and scarcity in which we work. I feel like we're always just, we're in like survival mode. And so we're not able to think longer term about investing in talent, investing in resources, investing in infrastructure.
I think the opening, Rhea, is possible because many of our board members certainly invest in the talent in their for-profit settings. And so if we can, again, better translate to them, look, you invest in your folks, you have training programs, you have professional development, and you see the literal benefit, the multiple benefit of the relationship management, frankly, that goes on in their business. And you just said it perfectly, Rhea. Think about the relationship relationship loss of that turnover of your fundraiser every 16 months. So it's not just the actual transactions during that year and a half, but it's the relationships that are lost that could have yielded tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars had we been more forward thinking.
But Patton, I mean, I think too that it's partially due to the way that we're funded, right? So how many times have we had to submit grants or talk to donors about overhead or like this is our administrative cost and or had government grants that only paid 3% of staff as if like programs happened without staff members. So that's a mystery to me.
So true.
So I guess I'm just wondering, like, how do we solve it? Because I 100% agree with you, which is we have to really invest in the sector, in the talent, in HR, in our people. But when we're sort of hamstrung by the funding mechanisms, how do we do it?
Well, I mean, obviously what you do so well, we need to call it out. And the so there's the kind of shaming of some of these funders who are creating an unrealistic environment for success. I'd like to think the logic of investing for the long term and using sustainability kind of arguments would help them understand that, yeah, we can't sustain this if we can't staff it, if we can't provide adequate personnel. Also, what I'm trying to do, and you do this well on the podcast, is lift up those funders who do seem to become more aware of this issue, that are funding with funding operations, are funding multi-year grants. And if we lift up their successes, I'm hoping, Rhea, that maybe some of the other funders will say, yeah, what? That does make sense. And I don't have to create such an impossible kind of cycle for those that I'm trying to grant. Because I think ultimately funders do want you to succeed, but we've got to get that kind of scarcity mindset out of their kind of boardrooms as well.
Pat, what I say, my three favorite words in the English language, it's not I love you, it's multi-year unrestricted funding.
Yes, that is at the very top of your favorite statements, isn't it? Yes.
That's right. Just put that on my gravestone. That's all I need. Multi-year unrestricted funding.
Okay. Amen. Yep.
We've got some good questions coming in. So Renee, do you want to unmute yourself? Why don't we start with your first question?
All right. Great. Hi. Good to see you guys.
Hey, Renee.
Hello. So my question was, this idea of vision, in the past, at different times, people have asked me, what's your vision for your next 10 years or your 20 years? That has not been the way that I have operated. It's been much more emergent. And even I actually am teaching a class now on nonprofit consulting, and I'm telling my students to think about small experiments that you can do. So I wonder how you find this balance. Of course, when you're a leader, you do need to tell people where you're going. But on the other hand, I think, especially with so much uncertainty that we're experiencing, how do you find that balance? Because if you're gonna go out too far, it's really not even, well, everybody had to kind of drop their visions anyway, in a lot
Such
of ways
a good point.
In March 2020. So I'm just curious, what you're thinking about this.
That's such a good question, Renee.
Good
and you're
question.
Right. I love it as a starting point. You're right. I think we put pressure on ourselves sometimes and even the term vision, yeah, has that long-term expectation. And like, yeah, I don't know. I can't imagine the next 6 months, much less 6 years. The vision framework concept that I've kind of experimented with, Renee, has been, all right, let's take the things that you do know. In other words, let's not put pressure on the long-term question. Maybe you have a general sense of leadership, which is mostly what I run into, but that's where breaking it down into the kind of subsector questions. Let's tackle the things you're comfortable asking. In other words, do you want to stay in healthcare? Do you want to stay in education? What are the sector questions? What about the type of environment you'd like to work? Whether it's short-term or long-term, because I find that gets people's wheels turning. Like, yeah, what I'd like to be in a large organization and have the variety of that professional experience. Others will say, you know what? I like a small organization. I like wearing more than one hat. So I don't know if Renee, that helps, but I find it when I'm coaching, yeah, I kind of let's leave the long-term question for later. Let's start with some of those immediate kind of questions. And then they begin to build a framework that may lead ultimately to what? And we do something too, I call job mapping, which allows folks to kind of experiment by researching jobs that might be of interest someday. And it allows them to, again, get their wheels turning without the pressure of, no, I'm not saying you should apply for the job, but begin to experience what other opportunities might look like. And we've had over a 4-month mastermind, people literally will change this vision framework over 4 months. And so again, Renee, great point that I think sometimes we put pressure on the long-term answer that maybe we don't need to push right away.
Well, let me ask a follow-up question here, Patton, because I'm going to name check Simon Sinek. Everyone's very much about find your why, right? But I feel like there's so much pressure there, and it can be really hard to find your why. So what's your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, I will take someone as far as they're willing to go. Again, most of the folks I'm working with have a general sense, yes, I would like to assume leadership in the sector, even if I'm not sure exactly what that means. You know, it doesn't have to. One, it may not be, it may mean leadership in the job you're in now. So I'm quick to point out, you don't have to go quit your job just because you have a dramatic vision of something else. Maybe you just want to be the very best at what you do and the impact you have at your organization and the communities you serve. But yeah, in terms of why and pushing that too hard, I simply don't. I just say, let's go as far as you're willing to go and we'll get there.
And I just want to call back to something that you said that I think is really interesting, because I think as a sector, as leaders in the sector, we have this narrative of like the great resignation and there aren't any good people out there and they're all leaving and they're all becoming TikTok influencers. But what I hear you saying is that they are out there, and that the reason that they may not be coming to your organization or staying in your organization is something that you should reflect on, as opposed to assuming that the problem is external.
Exactly. And I guess to reinforce that, what I say to leaders, obviously I love working with those that we're talking about that aspire to leadership, but also I turn it around for the leaders in the room, in any room, is what are you doing to make your organization attractive to any of those three categories, the emerging leader, the lateral entry, or the mid-career plateau? They're all out there. They're all talented. Why should they come to your organization? And what are you going to do to reinforce their genuine career ambition? Again, sadly, I just think a lot of times we get them here, they parachute in, and we hand them a three-ring notebook and wish them well. And is it any wonder they're leaving? But again, yeah. Hopefully, Rhea, that's something I know you'll continue to make the case as well.
Well, and I think for those of you listening, you should grab Patton's book and use it as a compass for your internal staff, right? Because if you can create a framework of this is what leadership looks like at this organization, because I think so often, especially with younger professionals, they don't know how would exactly. This is your first or second job out of college. But if you can create a framework around like, these are the competencies that you can develop, this is what leadership means, it actually gives them a roadmap to aspire to.
Exactly right. And that's my hope, because I didn't have it. I was fortunate to have. And of course, it led to the section on the strategic networking. I was just very fortunate to have mentors early on. And so I'm hoping I can kind of pass it forward, if you will.
Great. Okay. Great question coming in from Terry.
Hi, guys.
Hey, how
are you today? Good. So I am a nonprofit consultant. And in that role, I serve as a part-time executive director that puts in full-time hours and has other contracts. So one, I need to get your book, Patton, and I will. But these seven steps, talk a little bit about how they unfold. Is it more of an organic process? Is it more, hey, you should focus on step one before step two? And also, how do you fit this type of professional development in when you are already like overloaded with the work you have to get done on a day-to-day basis? Could you address that a little? How do we weave this into our professional work?
The intent is to present these concepts in sequence, because as I mentioned earlier, I think the vision framework leads to greater clarity on steps 2 through 7, but I'm quick to point out there's a parallel nature to these activities. In other words, you all know this, strategic networking is something you should constantly do. Mm-hmm. Curating knowledge, in other words, learning, has to be part of your lifelong plan. Mm-hmm. And so while they're introduced in sequence, I'm suggesting and hopefully providing tools in the book that allow you to maintain them. But Terry, you nailed the key point. In every one of our mastermind groups, one of the biggest issues comes up is I'm just so busy. And I wish I had a magic answer, but the answer is you have to carve out time for yourself. And I know that's easier said than done. One thing that I think our program has, the appreciation for the program is it's been forced study halls. The mastermind we do in 2-hour increments. and people who otherwise I think would not have carved out 2 hours for themselves do it because they enroll in the program. And then many of them say to me, what, I need to keep doing that. Maybe it's just 2 hours every 2 weeks, which is our frequency. But Terry, I'm convinced if, and I say this in reflection, so not at you, all of us need to carve out time for ourselves, because I know your to-do list is never going to end. And so I've, again, the ritual I put in play is sometimes that there's just one morning a week, a couple hours that I've got to block the calendar.
I've heard it before, and you're right. You just have to do it.
But here's the other piece too, Fenn, and I know this is going to be a controversial take, and I certainly would not have appreciated this as an ED, but I find that most people, not just EDs, but most people have not really sat down to make the distinction between being busy and being effective. And I think so often what I see with a lot of EDs is like, there's a lot of work that they do, but not all of it is actually going to move the needle. Not all of it is actually high ROI work. And so, and usually this comes with fundraising. I'd be curious about your perspective on this. It's like they fill their time doing stuff to avoid doing the stuff that they're uncomfortable doing, right? So like, I'm busy doing all my emails as opposed to calling the funder.
Such a good point. And again, you're right. There's a lot of martyrdom in terms of the volume of activity we take on as nonprofit leaders. But the question is exactly what you said. I know you're busy, but are you busy doing the right things? And so I talk about in the book, in that curate knowledge section, is I get it. You got a ton of stuff coming at you. How do you, though, on a regular, I would say weekly basis, organize it and determine the priorities? Because you're right, Rhea, they could spend all their time on doing other stuff. But as a fundraiser, this better than anybody, your top donors need relationship management. And are you taking the time to develop these relationships further? Or are you busying yourself on your nonprofit social media or emails or everything else you said, Rhea? Because it definitely exists. And I think it's something we have to cultivate as leaders, sharpening our prioritization skills so that we're doing the right things.
We didn't talk about boards. I want to talk about boards for a second, because often I think as an ED, you've got the three-ring circus going, you've got your funders, you've got your staff, you got this, that. And I feel like in theory, boards are supposed to help you to run the organization, manage and so on. And in theory, actually manage you as an ED. Right. But often that is not the case. And so boards end up being another thing to manage. So I'm curious, like, where do you see the responsibility of the board coming in with respect to nonprofit leadership and supporting the ED?
Such a good point. And I do. And it's in fact, in my top 10 list, that you as a aspiring nonprofit leader, certainly as you go higher up on the ladder, are going to have to understand the unique nuances of governance in the nonprofit sector, which includes having a boss, or actually a dozen bosses, or however many board members you have. And so I think one, staying on top of that and being proactive in terms of the relationship management of your board. And that's why, again, I think the best leaders treat their board with the relationship management they require. Because like you, Rhea, I run into a lot of leaders that come to me exasperated with either my board is micromanaging me or they're disengaged. So either way, they're not helping. And so how do we find that middle ground of effective engagement? But the best nonprofit leaders are proactive. They don't literally tell the board what to do, but I do think the best ones are proactive. They work in tandem with their board chair and create an environment that best engages those talented volunteers. Most of those board members are sitting there wondering what they're supposed to do. And if the nonprofit leader is sitting on the other side, not giving any guidance, I think it's a recipe for problems.
Yeah, that's such a good point, Pat. Well, I think the other piece to remember as well is that board members also want to grow and evolve, right? They're joining
exactly
a board
right. In
order to build their networks, build their skills. And I think we make the assumption that, like, just because you're in finance in your day job, you'll want to be on the finance committee. That may not be true. They may
want to
do something completely different to build their own skills. And I think we just need to remember that we're in the business of dealing with human beings who want to grow and learn and evolve.
That's such a good point. They came to your board likely for with a passion for the cause, and yet all we do is bombard them with staff reports and in fundraising asks, frankly. And yes, we want them to contribute, but you're right, Rhea, we're wasting their opportunities for engagement in other ways, which will include investment, I believe. But if we dismiss those other areas, we're missing out.
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell you how many EDs tell me in private, like, I just want them to write a check and get out of my way. Like, okay.
That's one way to approach it, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know that's a recipe for long-term success there. All right, we have time for one last question. Renee, you have an excellent question here. I want to get to it, and then we'll wrap it up.
This is such an interesting conversation. But one of the, I think, just thinking about the environment we're in and the incredible burnout that you already talked about, one of my questions, like, and some of these are kind of individual, okay, go do more self-care, da, da, da. But what is the community responsibility at this time, given that this is so pervasive? And have you seen any solutions that are working? I'm just really, I think, can we think beyond each ED needs to save themselves? Yeah.
That's such a good point.
That's so good. Renee, good questions. Well, so I actually just want to call out the Barr Foundation in Boston, because they have a program where EDs can apply to get a funded 3-month sabbatical. I think as a funder, if you're really invested in keeping talented leaders in the field, you have to recognize that they do need resources, they do need time off, they do need to recharge in order to be the best version of themselves. So I think it's a funder community issue. I think it's a board governance issue. And then I do think it's a responsibility of the community, because I'll just speak for myself personally. One of the things that really burnt me out as an ED is I felt like I was constantly being asked to deal with the care and feeding of my staff. And it wasn't about the work, it was about the personalities. And it was exhausting. And I'm like, I don't want to do
this again.
Such a
good point.
So anyway, Patton, your thoughts.
Well, no, I couldn't agree more. I find it's such a lonely position. And Renee and Rhea, you're both touching on it because of the reason you just said, Rhea, that my board is disengaged or my staff is turning over and I'm stuck in the middle. And so I guess, Renee, back to your question, the concept I mentioned, the personal board of directors, has been my response for me personally 15 years ago. And now what I'm trying to coach is creating an intentional small group that can, in fact, provide support. So what I get into there is literally, who do you want on your personal board? And often it is peers in similar roles. Maybe there's some aspirational peers, but maybe there are also just other thought partners that you need personally to help you when you are, in fact, stressed out, because we all are sometimes in our current environment. And so, Renee, that's one way. Strategic networking and then kind of an amplification of that has been this personal board concept, which I think has created a positive community for those that have tried it.
Yeah, and I just want to double click on something you said, Patton, because I think it's about community and relationships. Because at the end of the day, when we're in stress, we're in survival mode, right? Our amygdalas are going crazy. And the way that we bring ourselves into the executive state, as one of my guests, Eugene Choi, would say, is we build relationships with people who can help support us through these times. So last question for me, it's sort of a fun question I didn't ask for you in advance, but if you had a metaphorical billboard and you could communicate anything to the world aside from multi-year unrestricted funding.
You've already taken that one, right?
Yeah. Well, that's my personal billboard. But what would be on your billboard?
Carve time out for yourself. I find it came up today and it comes up in so many of, and it sounds so logical, but I am convinced, as one who was a victim of not taking that advice, I really believe there's such talent and energy in our sector, but we're losing it for the reasons we've discussed today, the burnout and other things. So find time for yourself that you can unplug, like you said, from sabbaticals to maybe it's just 1 hour a week that's your time. But those successful leaders, I'm finding, as busy as they are, do in fact carve out that time. And to me, that is essential for their mental health as well as the success of their organization.
It reminds me, one of my favorite quotes from Bruce Lee is, be like water. And so yes. If we can maintain our smooth equanimity, right? If we can flow, we can be like water.
Well put. Perfect.
All right, friend, where can people find you on the interwebs? I'm going to make sure to put all of your links in the show notes for folks listening to you on the podcast, but where would you like for folks to connect with you?
Well, grateful for that. I'm active on LinkedIn. So Patton McDowell or PMA Nonprofit Leadership on LinkedIn. The website is pattonmcdowell.com, and there you can find information about the book, the podcast, speaking that I'm doing, and the mastermind program that I've described during this conversation.
Wonderful. Well, Patton, thank you so much. This has been such a fun conversation. You and I could go on for days, but unfortunately, time is not our friend. So thanks very much. Thanks, everyone. Have a good day.